Blog Talk Radio.
Well, here we go, ladies and gentlemen, across the airwaves. We just finished the Doc Talk podcast out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. That was with Dr. Greg Roscoe talking about head and neck infections that can cause death. And now we go into this one, Sports Talk Saturdays, right out of Oakland, live there with Bruce Kessinger and Scott Morgenroth. Yours truly, Mark Mancini, producing it, 347-205-9631. This show goes quick, so if you want to catch the archive version, tell your friends, blogtalkradio.com/Mancini Sports, podcast platforms, wherever you subscribe to podcasts, powered now by Mancini Media. More of them, less of me. Let me lay the red carpet down. Put the podium in its place. Hand off the mic. Bruce, you first. Give it over to Scott. And then that great guest coming through, former Penn State Detroit Lion, Keith Doherty, coming in talking about his book as well. Bruce, how are you? And how can people get a hold of you?
First off, I'm regretting parlaying your Pittsburgh Steelers with the Coastal Carolina Chanticleers. I should have stuck with my Western Kentucky Hilltoppers. I can be reached at holyroller91978@gmail.com or on Facebook. Over to you, Scott.
All right, Bruce, thank you very much. And by the way, I'm here in Talladega, Alabama. We have some NASCAR this weekend. So anyways, you can contact me through my website, www.southfloridatribune.com, on Twitter, @TribuneSouth. But most of all, please subscribe to the South Florida Tribune YouTube channel, South Florida Tribune YouTube channel. I'm here in Talladega, Alabama. Got out of Florida to do some Major League NASCAR race. And Keith, if it weren't for you, I probably might have taken a flyer, but I've been looking for this show for a long time. Love doing it, but this is just even more special. From Talladega all the way to you, Keith. And by the way, I used to be a beat writer for the Detroit Monitor, so I remember working with you back in the day.
Hey, right on. Hey, it's great to be on the show. I can't say I have favorable memories, you know, about the state of Alabama, but I'm glad you're there. I'm glad you're safe, and enjoy the race.
Yeah, if you knew what I had to do to get through in the middle of the night, it would make you crazy what I had to endure in Georgia. But I'll leave that for another day. I don't want to steal your thunder today. But we'll leave it out there. If anybody wants to ask me in the chat, then maybe I'll go ahead and tell them. But I want the focus to be on you and your book for sure and the Lions.
Yeah, we should start with the book. We should start with the books because I don't want to spoil anything. We'll let Keith tell us what it's about and all of that right now.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, back in the 2000s, I was coming out of the NFL and didn't really know what I wanted to do when I grew up. So I went ahead and spent a good deal of time working at all different types of things. And the two things that I discovered I really liked to do was teaching and writing. So that's what I set out to do. I taught at many different levels. I taught emotionally handicapped kids. I taught kids that were basically, on parole from the authorities. And I taught high school for 4 years as well. Now, I got into writing, and the first book I wrote was Black in Honolulu Blue, which was a memoir of my football playing days. And this includes back at Emmaus High School in Emmaus, Pennsylvania. I grew up in Macungie, Pennsylvania, close by, as well as at Penn State, playing under Joe Paterno. And I actually have a Jopa chapter in there. And then, of course, my time with the Detroit Lions. Now, since getting out of football, money has always been a topic that I enjoyed talking about, enjoyed researching. And I kind of got into this whole financial literacy thing and how a lot of people are handicapped because they don't have financial information available to them. Things are complicated, and if you're not educated, you're going to suffer. And this is especially true these days with sky high interest rates. Once again, I heard mortgages now going 7%. Right, this seems like last week they were at 2.5%. So you can visit financialauthor.com. That's what I call myself these days, a financial author, financialauthor.com. That'll take you to my website, and I have a very interesting newsletter that I publish every month on the full moon. You can sign up. You can sign up for the newsletter there. Also, if you'd like, I have a free book offer going right now. Another book of mine, Best Debt Elimination Plan. If you have debt right now, credit card debt, automobile debt, it's just going to get worse. Interest rates are continuing to go high. I feel guilty charging you for this book, so I give it away for free. And again, go to financialauthor.com, and you can sign up for my newsletter. You can get that free book.
Okay. Well, we'll start here because we do have a guest, or rather one of our listeners, Dave from Flint, Michigan, says, wow, Keith Dorney, top 10 pick of the Lions. What's your thoughts on the team today?
Well, first off, as you may know, it's not easy being a Detroit Lion fan. And that's what I've been, ever since they drafted me in the first round, the 10th pick back in 1979. I've been a roaring Detroit Lions fan, but it's tough. It's tough. And I've learned to have lower expectations as far as results go. But, so I came into this year a bit pessimistic. But I got to tell you, watching this, that Hard Knock show, which I never watched before. It was the first time I've watched it. We watched a few episodes, catching a few games. I mean, they're playing some good football. They're playing inspired football, and they have good talent, on both sides of the ball. What do you think about the Lions this year? I'd be interested to hear what you say about them.
Okay, I think, first off, I like the coach. It seems like he's got the players here, and they're playing harder. And I mean, I've always sort of liked the Lions. How can you hate a team that loses a lot? But my interest in the Lions actually also goes back to the fact that I'm originally from Berkeley, and you have a Cal quarterback manning the helm there. You now have running backs that are good, although he's hurt, good receivers, TJ Hockenson, great tight end. I think it's going in the right direction. They're playing everybody tight. I always wish the Lions luck. I liked Greg Landry. I liked running quarterbacks. In fact, that was the last time I remember where they made playoffs with any regularity. So I think you're going to have a good season. I don't know about wild card, but you're going to give some people some trouble. That's what I think about the Lions.
All right, okay. Keith, let me ask you a question. When was the last time the Lions won a championship? What year and what date?
Well, that's an easy one because that was the year I was born, 1957.
All right, do you remember the date?
No, I don't. I don't. I would imagine it was somewhere near the end of the year.
Yeah, well, I'd like to throw this at people, Keith. It was on my birthday, December 29th, 1957. Problem was, it was 5 years before I was born.
How about that?
That's a great trivia.
Well, you share a birthday with my mother, and we're the same age.
Look at that. Well, no, I was born in 1962.
You were
5 years before I was born, but the date. So when people
the first part of the date, not the last part. I get it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I always like to joke around with people. If anybody wants to go back, just Google them. Hey, let me tell you another interesting story, okay? Every time I associate Billy Martin's death, okay, here's a good one for you. I always associate the fact that I got my ankle torn up in New England on Christmas Day. So I always remember when I have medical records about what happened to me in New England on Christmas Day, I always think of Billy Martin, maybe for all the right or wrong reasons. Now, about Dan Campbell, okay, anybody that's willing to do push-ups with his team is all right in my book. Here's a guy, doesn't dress like Tom Landry, scrap the suit and tie. Then again, nobody ever does it these days. Anyway, if you're willing to do push-ups with your team, okay, and they're willing to play to the last, even though they lose a lot of close games, how can you not like this guy? Really, think about it, right? I'm willing to do push-ups. Yeah. You know what the drill is.
Now, I hear you. I have to admit, though, when he first came out with that knee-biting thing, right, when he was first named coach, I'm like, oh, man, it's, what's this guy trying to do? This is the NFL. I know he played some, MCDC, right? But he's won me over. He's won me over. I agree with everything he said, everything that was said previously. I think he does have the ear of the team. I think they are playing hard for him. And, hey, that's half of it. Now one thing that was a problem with the Lions when I played for them was that the different facets of the team weren't on the same page. And I believe, and this is true in industry, as well as football, you got to have the guys up top there in the suits, as well as the guys sweeping the floor and everybody in between. You got to have them on the same page. And that certainly wasn't the case when I played. If I can, a quick personal anecdote. Except for my first contract, I negotiated all my own contracts. And I actually, helped other players when I was older negotiate their own contracts too. So I was up there talking to Russ Thomas, the general manager, for quite some time. I went up there and the first thing that Russ Thomas said when I sat down to talk to him, and by the way, while he was talking, he was looking through his stock holdings on his Merrill Lynch statement, and the only reason I knew that is because I had a Merrill Lynch account too. And, I knew it was the same kind of paper. So, the audacity of this guy, pay attention to me. But anyway, first thing he asked me, hey, what does Monty Clark say about me? And Monty Clark being the head coach. Then we went on, we had a discussion. I don't think he really listened to what I was saying. Like I said, he was looking at his stock holdings. So I left. I'm going down the stairs to the locker room, and Monty Clark's coming up the other way. And he stops me. And real serious, he asks me in a low voice. He goes, "Hey, Keith." He goes, "What did Russ Thomas say about me?" So, both of these guys hate each other, right? They're paranoid that they're talking behind each other's back. How can you win? How can you win in that type of situation? I actually admired Monty Clark. I thought he was a great human being, a great football coach. And I'm grateful, to him for picking me, when he did. And I thought we had some great teams back then, but I think he was hamstrung because, they weren't on the same page.
Well, anybody that worked with Russ Thomas wasn't on the same page. Come on, he's a financial guy, not a football guy. No disrespect to the Lions, but when you draft Lynn Bodine in the first round instead of some of these other guys from schools that you can sign them, he's looking at the bottom line, not the best player. I remember that. In fact, I actually met Keith Monty Clark over on Sports Talk, and he was talking before the Lions draft coverage, before you were actually drafted. And I looked at his sheet, and he was very open about showing it to me. He's really a nice guy. And you got to remember, he's an offensive lineman dream because he worked for the Miami Dolphins and was part of that undefeated team. So he knows a lot about the offensive line and helped lead them. So I'm with you all the way when it comes to Clark. I met him. Very, very nice guy. And, when you deal with an offensive lineman and you're a position coach, then you can certainly have a much better relationship. So you say you negotiated your own contracts. So you kind of set me up for this. What are your thoughts about Lamar Jackson going out there and negotiating his own contract? I mean, that's unreal.
I think it's great, personally. I think it's great. I really do. I think it's great. Although, certainly in his position where what he's playing out is his option this year, right? So, that's a risky thing for him to do. And there might be some personality involved there. That's a sticky situation. I think I would be more comfortable being represented by an agent if I was in his situation. You have to remember, back then we weren't talking about tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars. We were talking about a few thousand dollars. We didn't get paid like these guys do today. I'm of that group, called the pre-93ers, right? Before free agency, took hold.
Yeah.
But you got to remember though, with a guy like Lamar Jackson, you know, he's being a multi-threat dual quarterback. You're right, Keith. He's one hit away from being knocked out for a while. So you're right. The risk is, you wonder if the reward will be worth the risk, and that's the TBD that we're going to find out down the line. But I'm totally with you. Maybe in his case, an agent, but I know you guys weren't making as much money then, so I can appreciate where you're coming from. But I had to ask you that since you're talking about being able to represent yourself. You left me so wide open. If I were a play-by-play guy, I'd hire you as my analyst because of that segue.
Yeah.
Take that
as a compliment.
Well,
you were talking about – yeah, go ahead.
Take that.
Who's going?
So, all right. So anyways, Keith, you go from one Lions to another, Penn State, Detroit. What was that like when you were drafted? Not like you had to really change the name of the team at all, did you? Nittany versus Lions?
Yeah, that was convenient. Yeah, going from a Lion to a Lion. I was all excited, and I get there, and guess what? We went 2-14. I literally played every down of all 20 games. We had 16 games back then and 4 preseason games. And Monty figured, hey, you're a rookie, you got to get NFL experience. And he never took me out, even when it was like the fourth quarter of a freaking, you know, the third preseason game. I'm still in there playing, but God blessed Monty Clark again. I think I really felt a lot of him.
Monty Clark, by the way, that last Lion victory, 1957, I believe, was 31-27 over the 49ers. I'm not sure if Monty Clark was on that Niner team. But Monty Clark did coach the 49ers in 1976, I believe. And
yes,
they had a change of owners that year. The DeBartolos bought it off the original owners, and Monty Clark had a decent year that year. They had Plunkett at quarterback. I believe they went 7-6-1 that year, and they would have won more games if their kicker Steve Mickemeyer hadn't gone wide right and wide left in some big, big moments. But the next year they sacked Clark, and I thought it was very unjust. Did Monty Clark ever talk about that? Because I felt bad for him.
Yeah, I got to know Monty on a more personal level after I was retired and done playing. He reached out to me. You know, he knew I was a writer, and Monty had a very dry sense of humor. And if you got to know him, he really was quite hilarious. But again, it was like just so dry. And he had a collection of anecdotes and such that he was trying to get published. And I tried to help him do that. And I think it was near the end of his life, and I think he was dying, and he didn't let me know that at the time, very stoic of him. But again, it was nice to spend that time with him post football careers.
So, Keith, let's go into your book. The foreword was written by Joe Montana. So you obviously had that 49er connection with a guy as established as Montana. Plus, he's also been a good business guy away from the football field. One of the things I'm amazed about certain NFL players is not only what they did on the field, but off the field. And I remember at one point, here I am in a NASCAR venue, Talladega Super Speedway. Thanks to Russell Branham for accommodating us. But, you know, Joe Montana was in auto racing and did a lot of good things as well. I believe he was at IndyCar, if I remember right. I don't know. But he was in motorsports nonetheless. So what, for you, what motivated you to have Joe Montana write the foreword for your book?
Well, first off, I'm indebted to Joe for writing that foreword, and he did a really great job. I really love the foreword. It was weird. That goes back to one of my many jobs that I had. You know, after I figured out I love teaching and writing. You know, and again, the 4 years that I spent at Cardinal Newman High School in Santa Rosa were great. They were great. I was the ninth grade English teacher, and the reason I taught English was that, you know, I was getting my teaching credential along with my master's degree from the University of San Francisco, and it came time for us to choose what subjects we wanted to teach, and I was mm-hmm. I was a business major, you know, at Penn State. I had my degree from Penn State Business, so I figured that's what I'd be teaching. But lo and behold, all you had to do was pass a test, right, and then you could teach that subject. You know, I think that rattles a lot of people these days, but I took advantage of it. You know, selfishly, I said, hey, what am I going to benefit most from? And that, since I was, you know, actively writing, I thought, you know, I could use a little help on the English side. So I somehow passed the exam, became an English teacher. And two of his daughters were, you know, attending Ursuline, which is right next door, Ursuline High School, which is now a part of Cardinal Newman High School. At the time, right. The boys and the girls' schools were separate. And I got to know both of them, you know, as I got to know most of the kids at the schools. And I politely asked one of the gals to forward a note to Joe, and later I got to talk to Joe personally. And again, he was very, very friendly and was anxious to help me out. So that was a big boon to the book sales, to say the least.
All right, so let's continue on with the book. Sorry, Bruce. You know, but I want to really get deeper into this. You know, we talk about the book being unfiltered view of life and your views of football at the highest level. Can you elaborate what you meant by going along those lines and being able to convey that message to your readers?
Yeah, absolutely. I've always been a keen observer, you know, more so than other people I've noticed. And that helped me, you know, take note of things in football that, you know, that a lot of people don't hear about or even want to talk about. You know, as the name implies, you know, the title, of course, you know, Black and Honolulu Blue and Silver are the Detroit Lions colors. So that's where I got the name. And obviously Black and Honolulu Blue, that connotates getting beat up. And I do talk a lot about part of the game, injuries.
Right.
You know, as an offensive lineman, obviously – you know, I was injured all the time. And back then, with no limitations on hitting in practice, et cetera, or the length of the preseason, you know, we did a lot more hitting than the guys do today. And that took a terrible toll, you know, not only on me, but, you know, on my compadres as well. And, you know, a lot of people don't think about that. That's why – you know, to segue into college football, that's why I'm all for what's going on right now, even though it's chaos. Right? Most of them, you know, they play, you know, 4 years, they get beat to all, you know, get out, and then, you know, they have nothing to show for it. And I think it's high time we start paying those players.
Well, let's face the reality, okay? And being from that area, I'm sorry to interrupt you. You played at the Pontiac Silverdome. You played at the Hubert H. Humphrey Metrodome. And you know what? Covering games there, I was allowed on the field like several minutes, like 5 to 7 minutes before the end of the game. And you were playing on cement with artificial surface. That doesn't beat the daylights out of somebody's body. Then tell me what's worse, somebody getting hit with a baseball bat or being hammered to the ground with concrete and artificial surface. And you had the Metrodome, which ended Billy Sims' career. And I have to tell you that when I covered a game at the Metrodome, I had fluid down my knee after covering it when my hiking boot got caught in there, and I had an issue with my knee. I never did anything to the Vikings. It's just when you're on artificial surf, your body takes a toll. You get hammered by all these guys. There's no doubt that it has to take a toll on you and anybody else on the planet. And we know that the Hubert H. Humphrey Metrodome ended Billy Sims' career. So not only did you take the brunt of the hits, but you played on horrible surfaces as well.
Yeah, thanks for bringing up Billy Sims. Again, he was drafted the year after me, and we pretty much led the league in rushing, or were at the top in the top five those next 4 years. He was a heck of a running back. Everybody, you know, thinks of the other number 20, you know, when they think of the Detroit Lions, but Billy wasn't too bad either. Someone who read Black and Honolulu Blue once told me that they thought that the Pontiac Silverdome surface, the Astrodome surface, was a character in my book because I described it in such detail. And it was pitiful because the Lions didn't own the Pontiac Silverdome. The city of Pontiac owned the Silverdome, and that turf by the time I was playing on it, was in incredible need of replacement. You know, that little, you know, white foam thing that they put down on the concrete before they put the green thing over, that was like nothing. That was like disintegrated and you know, less than a quarter of an inch and missing in most places. And because of the way they laid it out, there were seams. And I could name several players. Tom Tenor comes to mind first, who, and their career was ended by one of those seams, their foot getting caught in that seam. And again, the Lions were unwilling to do anything about the surface. The city of Pontiac, it didn't have enough money to replace the surface, so we just kept playing on it and playing on it. And it was filthy, too. It was filthy. We would get turf burns, and all of a sudden, you know, that would turn into a major injury because, a huge staph infection because of the Rolling Stone concert that they had, you know, 3 days before the game, right?
Hey, listen, I know about that service I work. So I've got to ask you something that really came to mind as you were making that description. We know you're a savvy businessman, but I don't think you were involved with Billy Simms' decision to sign two contracts, one with Houston of the USFL as well as the Lions, right? I don't think you could ever be – anybody can make a move that savvy, right? I mean, if it wasn't hilarious, it was crazy. remember when you signed those two contracts?
I do, and I have empathy for Billy and a lot of other guys because, you're 19, 20, 21 years old, and you really don't know anything, and all of a sudden, these people with money, they're telling you how great they are and what you should do, And I must admit I fell for all of that stuff too early on, but wised up probably, you know, sooner than most. And I certainly back in the locker room would preach money management, till I was blue in the face. And I did have a couple of people that listened, but again, you know, most players, you know, they a lot of them grew up poor. The first time they have money, they have a lot of family members putting pressure on them to do this and to do that. Right. And it's really a tough situation. So I have empathy for Billy, certainly, signing two contracts, not a good idea.
Yeah. Well, I remember Jerry Arkovitz was the owner of the Houston Gamblers. And I know that was a sticky situation. Thankfully he went back to Detroit, but you know, when we're talking about a guy like you, who's a very savvy business person. That's the thing I love about NFL players, not only what they do on during their career, but what they do after. And that's the thing I've always admired so much about you, Keith, is it's not, because everybody knows that the average NFL career is short, but what you do later to me defines your legacy. And that leads me to my next question. You have one section that you talk about a typical football game from the point of view of your wife. And then you have another section that talks about post-retirement visit to the locker room and what's changed. So can you talk about both of those points, please?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's funny. I was visiting Ford Field, shortly after it was built. And, this was, of course, decades after I had retired. And, the first time I was there was when my compadre Matt Millen was the general manager. That's a whole other subject. It didn't work out too well. But I said, "Hey, so where's the players section?" I went to Matt, because like back in my day, every player would get two tickets, and when you played at home, it would be right on the 50-yard line, and all the players' wives and such would sit together. And he just laughed. He goes, "We don't have a player section anymore." He goes, "Everybody has, they just rent their own suite because they're all multimillionaires." I'm like, "Oh, yeah, duh." So my wife, actually she was my girlfriend at the time. She was a wife, I guess, near the end of my career. We got married. And she would sit in the players' wives section, and it was, a lot of times it was very competitive. Certainly a lot of beautiful women And, you know, all of them would try to outdo themselves a lot of times and dress to the nines. My Catherine, who, by the way, I'm still married to, 38 years.
Good for you.
You know, she wasn't all into that, but she would sit back and describe this to me. So I actually tried something experimental and, you know, tried to speak through her, you know, first person, you know, to kind of give a perspective from a player's wife, at least back in the 80s.
Well, you want to know an irony, Keith? I married a Green Bay Packers girl. How do you like that, my friend?
Well, my wife, actually, that's how I ended up in California. She's born in Long Beach, California, so I fell in love with a California girl, so that's how I ended up here on the West Coast.
Well, if I want to get really descriptive of this whole thing, and I never talk about my personal life on the show, I actually found her on plentyoffish.com, and I told her there's no reason why the Lions and the Packers can't be teammates. 10 years later, I guess it kind of worked out. So, on our wedding, the Lions and the Packers played, and when I introduced her to Bill Keenis, Bill liked her anyway. And Bill's one of the classiest people you can ever meet. I don't know how often you're in touch with him. But, yeah, it's interesting how these relationship things kind of work out.
Yeah, Bill Keenis is like about the nicest. Bill Keenis is like the nicest person I ever met. I swear, he's a really nice guy. Again, he was there while I was there as well.
Now, the second part of your question,
you asked me about how in my book when I went back to Ford Field and you know, I went and I visited Matt Millen it was really surreal. You know, after I talked to Matt, their offices are right there at Ford Field. You know, I was walking down and, I said, man, I'm going to go out and step on the field. So I walked down the, you know, jumped over the little chain, you know, went down on the, you know, on the turf and like within 5 seconds, like two security guards, you know, had me by the arm and were escorting me out. And I'm like, hey man, you know, I used to play here. They're like, yeah. So they escorted me off, and I'm thinking, man, nobody even knows who I am around here anymore. Which of course, you know, being a obscure offensive lineman, you know, who played decades before, of course, you know, of course that's the way it's going to be. But it just was kind of a big shock. You know, it used to be a big deal back in Detroit. You know, not so much anymore. Mm-hmm. Kind of put me in my place a little bit.
So tell me, what was it like to be the lead blocker for Billy Sims? I'm sorry, Bruce. I do apologize. But being the lead blocker for Billy Sims, very tactical runner. He was patiently waiting for his holes and all that. I love watching him play. And, of course, he did well in business because he has a barbecue restaurant. But go ahead and talk about them. Sorry, Bruce. You there?
Well, thank you for mentioning the offensive line, you know, back then. Russ Bollinger, Chris Dietrich. Rich Stringer, you know, tight end Rob Rubick, later Lomas Brown and Kevin Glover. Those are still really good friends of mine, you know, people I keep in touch with. Again, a lot of camaraderie in the offensive line room.
Well, you're a lead blocker for arguably one of the best running backs that could have been better if it weren't for the fact that you had poor pathetic turf. And Billy Sims' career could have been a lot better. So, you know, I like to give you your offensive linemen their props. But, you know, what are your thoughts about Billy Sims being a lead blocker for a guy like this?
Oh, man, it was just a joy, let me tell you.
Yeah.
Billy, first off, he was an incredibly tough guy, an extremely gifted runner. And, boy, did you know, he take some punishment. He really took a lot of punishment, but, boy, he was just such a special runner. You know, he wouldn't run away from you. He wasn't the fastest guy in the world. But man, he had some moves and was tough, and it was just such a great honor to block for him because you never knew when he was going to break one, right? All of a sudden, you know, you're down on the ground, you know, finishing your guy off, and you see Billy dart by you, so you run up and you're running downfield, and the way he went, you know, sometimes you'd get a block, you know, because some guy would be coming back into your purview, you know, because of all the moves that he was making. A lot of times he ran a lot farther, you know, than the actual game, sometimes three or four times as far. So that was a lot of fun. That was a lot of fun. We had a lot of good running backs. We always had a good running game, you know, even in the latter years that I played there. I think that has a lot to do with two really good offensive line coaches. First Fred Hoagland and then Bill Muir. I was very blessed to have two very great offensive line coaches. That has a lot to do with it.
Now, speaking of runners that tore up their knee and stuff on turf, I'm just curious. I hope I got my time frame right. Did you block for Kurt Warner at Penn State by chance?
No, I was a little before him. I'm older than him.
Okay.
So you know, we had Matt Suey, Mike Gooman. You know, were our two top running backs. You know, my senior year. So that was a little too old to play with him.
Another thing for the layman, us laymen out there. A while back at one of my high school reunions, there was a girl. I'm not going to mention her name or anything. I found out she was married later to an NFL lineman, and he had a problem. I won't get into it, but you know, I was asking her about it just because the curiosity about, wow, what's it like to be an NFL wife and all the glamour and all of that. And she basically said it wasn't only glamorous; it was just like a regular job, but you guys got paid a little more. Is that basically how it is? You go to practice, it's like a regular routine day, and then you just come home and, I mean, and all of that. I just, as a layman, I'm curious what your opinion is on that.
Yeah, pretty much, but certainly there's some stardom that goes along with it. Even though I was an offensive lineman, well, you know, back then I was like 305 pounds, 6 feet five. Whenever I walked into a room, someone either figured I was a professional wrestler or a football player, no matter where that would be. So even if people didn't recognize me, you know, or in and around Detroit, you know, they certainly did because of my size. And I think most offensive linemen have that problem. During the season, you know, it's not like we're gone a lot. You know, it's not like baseball players who go on the road for a month. You know, we're playing in Green Bay. You know, we leave Saturday and we're back Sunday night. So, quick trip.
You know, Keith, I got to go back to Billy Sims. I'll never forget the time I made Jimmy the Greek look like the biggest idiot I have ever seen. You know, Jimmy the Greek, oh, the Rams are going to roll over the Lions. They're going to roll over the Lions. What do you think happened? The Lions came out there and beat the daylights out of the Rams. Jimmy the Greek looked like Jimmy the Geek. What it was over with, or whatever you want to call him. I'm sure you got to remember Billy Sims' first game walking into Southern California. Take that, Jimmy. It was pretty fun.
Yeah, that was opening day 1980. And,
right, I know.
I kind of had my hands full playing against a guy named Jack Youngblood, right? Billy had quite a debut that game. I remember that game. Very, very well. I remember the plane ride home. I remember Monty ordered like 15 extra cases of Coors for the plane ride home. So that was nice. That's a day I'll cherish for sure.
Yeah, nobody understands that another one bites the dust came from a lot of that when the Lions got off at an incredible start and faded a little bit toward the end. Only a guy like me that's only been brought up in the game my whole life would remember that and you being a part of it. So let's talk about Penn State being in the Big Ten. I've always wondered about this, you being a Nittany Lion. You know, it's one thing to play as a college independent, but when you get into a conference like Penn State, I hate to say, have they been humble being in the Big Ten, or do they – because in my opinion, the competition is so much different now that they're in the Big Ten instead of picking your opponent and getting an automatic 9, 10, 12 wins all the time.
Yeah. Back when I played at Penn State, we were an independent. We were you know, with Notre Dame, the only two big independents.
Right.
You know, it was years later that we joined the Big Ten. I don't know if you can really say humbled. I think certainly the Penn State football program was, you know, hamstrung for quite a few years, you know, because of the whole situation there. And I think that probably has more to do with their poor performance over that portion of time than anything. I think certainly you're gonna see Penn State compete well with their Big Ten opponents this year. So far, they have anyway. I haven't been as excited about a Penn State football team in quite some time. Not only do they have great people on both sides of the ball that are upperclassmen and are leaders, but they got a freshman class that's just so full of potential, including a running back and a quarterback. So very exciting time to be a Nittany Lion fan these days.
Yeah, but I think Joe Paterno got more than he bargained for when he joined the Big Ten. Not that they didn't want to, because let's face the reality, when Penn State joined the Big Ten, with the competition comes the money as well, and obviously you want to be associated with a power conference like they are. So I'm not saying it was a bad move for them, but it's a far different schedule being an independent than it is to be in a conference where you face each other every year and you make adjustments as such.
No, it's true, but still, Penn State gets to pick their preseason opponents, right? And because their actual conference schedule is so difficult because of the good teams in the Big Ten, most of those are softball games too, So I don't know if it's that much different. Certainly, you hit the nail on the head when you said why they joined the Big Ten and the amount of money that big-time college football programs make is just mind-boggling, and the trickle-down effect, just incredible. And, again, I said this earlier, but I'm a big fan of just paying the college players. The way I didn't make this up, but I think it's a good idea. Have some schools that do offer academic scholarships or athletic scholarships. And maybe a small salary, and people can go there. And then there's other teams that all you do is play football, and there is no education. And I know that's going to mess all these rivalries up and upset a lot of people, but to me, that's the only equitable solution to getting more money to why the game, why it's popular in the first place, and that's the players. That's the players.
So talk about the toughest defense that you played against, any one specific player that you didn't want to face. And then the second part of that question is, could you have imagined playing against Dick Butkus?
I could have imagined playing against Dick Butkus. I mean, I played against Jack Lambert, and Mean Joe Green. I mean, I played against a lot of great offensive linemen. Defensive linemen. Who's the best player that I've played against?
Yeah.
I'd have to give that to Reggie White. The first time I saw Reggie White was when he was with the Philadelphia Eagles, and he was actually playing inside as a tackle. I was also a tackle, playing against defensive ends most of my career. Then he subsequently was switched to defensive end, played against him a few times there with the Eagles. And then they traded him, of course, to Green Bay, who we played twice a year. So I saw a lot of Reggie. And the reason that Reggie was so good, well, there were players like William the Refrigerator Perry, okay? I'm going up against him. He's not going to run around me. So I know the only way he's going to beat me is run through me. Well, I can handle that. Okay. Then there's guys like Lawrence Taylor. He's actually a bad example because he could run you over too, but he could run around you as well. And that's what Reggie's strength was. He could run around you or run over you, which was really hard to defend. I had some epic battles with Ed Too Tall Jones, with Howie Long, probably the best defense I played against. And the defense that I hated the most was the Bears front. Of course, we played them twice a year. They're in the old NFC Central, and they played that defense where they'd cover the three interior linemen, have the two defensive ends You know, most of that line is in the Hall of Fame, including the guy I played against most of the time, Dan Hampton. That was a heck of a defensive line. They got the last laugh on me. We were playing my last year of football in the late 80s, Monday Night Football, we're playing the Bears, and it's the third quarter, and there's an interception. And I always come alive when there's an interception, not that I'm, you know, sleeping in the huddle or anything, but when there's an interception, I always tried to make the tackle. I would run right at the ball carrier as fast as I could, and I thought that was the best chance that I had of making the tackle, because a lot of times, right, there's other, you know, they're juking around and not really going anywhere. So there's an interception. I'm running full speed, which isn't very fast, and I'm just about ready to make the tackle, and the lights go out. And I literally don't remember anything for the rest of the day. I was knocked unconscious for about 20 seconds. And as it turns out, I didn't know this till the next day when I watched the film, it was William the Refrigerator Perry who had hit me. He was running full speed the other way.
Wow.
Yeah, so a couple of my teammates helped me out. And much to the hilarity of the Chicago sideline, I start walking towards the Chicago sideline. And I remember Chris Dietrich, the other offensive tackle, came and got me. You know, I saw this on the film. And, you know, he walked me back to our sidelines. You know, they went ahead and had the ball. And, you know, by the time we were ready to go back in, they just put me back in. I played the rest of the game, even though I don't remember any of it. You know, watching the film the next day or the day after, I really didn't remember any of the fourth quarter. So that was one of my many concussions and one of the few times that I was actually knocked unconscious. But, yeah, just to give you an idea of the brutality of the game.
Right. Speaking of which, that Miami situation with Tua that happened last, Thursday and the Sunday beforehand, who do you think bears responsibility? Some people say the coach. This was a rookie head coach. The difficulty of a coach, first off, you know, you're supposed to care about your player, but if the player is so adamant that he can still play and your team's 2-0 and stuff, I don't know. Do you think the coach is responsible, or is the doctors recommending it to the coach who would be considered the responsible parties as far as trying to sending somebody back in there? Does the coach listen to the doctors and abide by what doctors say, or is the coach making an independent decision here?
No, I think that ultimately it is the coach's decision, but certainly going against a medical opinion by the doctor, that's immoral, you know, as well as illegal.
Yeah.
And I don't really know what happened. I saw both incidences, and that first instance, it certainly did appear that, you know, he had some kind of conscious problem, you know, even though, you know, he claimed that it wasn't. It sure looked like it to me. And then, of course, that, you know, the horrific follow-up injury 4 days later. That's the other thing. I mean, you know, it's great to have Thursday night football. I admit to loving Thursday night football, right? I'm a big football fan. I like it Monday, Thursday, Sunday. But playing 4 days apart, certainly does put a toll on your body.
So Keith, I've got some more questions.
One last one here. Do you think that? Because since you've had concussions, he's got another 11 days before he has to be on the field. Do you think that's going to be long enough for him to recover from the recent concussions, or do you think they should sit him out?
I don't know. I can't see how he's going to play, you know, after they made such a big deal about this now, and the spotlight is on them. I think they're certainly going to err, you know, on the conservative side, but it's tough for a player to make the call on when they're ready to play after a concussion. I certainly think that, there is protocol in place, and I think that protocol should be applied to this situation. And supposedly, you know, it's an independent it's an independent decision where, you know, the coaches and even the team doctor are left out of it. So I don't see how he's going to even play in 10 days, even if he was ready.
All right, Keith, I got two more questions. First of all, what coach made the biggest impact on your life, Joe Paterno, Monty Clark, or Daryl Rogers?
Well, it certainly wasn't Daryl Rogers. Okay, Daryl Rogers was a horrible head coach, and he brought in a horrible staff. And you know, you talk about coaches not getting fired fast enough. He was one of them. Okay, Now I was lucky again during that time. Bill Muir, you know, was my offensive line coach, who was an excellent coach. So I was very, very lucky. I was very fortunate during the Daryl Rogers time. You know, I got to give the nod to Monty because I liked Monty. And by the time I left Penn State, I did not like Joe Paterno at all. I didn't like him at all. No. So I got to go with Monty Clark. You know, the truthful answer to that probably was my high school coach, Fritz Halfacre, back at Emmaus High School. He probably had the biggest influence on me because if it wasn't for him, I probably wouldn't have played football. I just would have continued playing basketball. And, you know, he recognized my potential as a freshman and developed me, you know, into a decent lineman. And I don't think that would have happened otherwise. So I'd have to say Fritz Halfacre, George Fritz Halfacre.
All right, so let me go back on Bruce's point, and that leads – and thanks for bringing it up to Bruce, okay? How safe is the game today, and have they made enough safety enhancements? Because obviously the Tua thing is a bad look. I know they've tried to improve the helmet. But give us the state of the game in terms of safety, and have they made enough safety enhancements?
Well, first off, whenever you talk to an old-timer like me, you're always going to get this, and that is – my goodness, you know, football isn't the same game as when we played. I mean, we would, you know, we would have contact Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, and sometimes even Saturday mornings before a Sunday game. And that was just routine. We used to have, you know, 2 months of hitting in preseason rather than 2 weeks, you know, interspersed over a period of time. So, you know, it's really hard to make comparisons. Certainly though, you know, looking at the violence of the game, you know, there's no question, you know, players have gotten big, you know, bigger. I mean, I thought I was big, you know, 6'5", about 305 pounds. And then you look at a guy like, what's his name? McClinchy, right? With the Niners, their right tackle, you know, he's 6'7.5", you know, 335 pounds. Are you freaking kidding me? You know, so, you know, players are bigger, they're faster, they're stronger, and of course, those impacts are more intense because of that. I think that they've come a long way as far as protecting players, but I think that that they can do more. You know, football, especially pro football, very slow to change, and you know, I think that, you know, things have to happen, you know, before they'll take action, you know, bad things.
Well, Keith, let me tell you something, Keith. You're talking about a guy, okay, me, that was actually at the only game in NFL history where a man died on the field. I was at the game where Chuck Hughes died of a heart attack at Tiger Stadium. Can you imagine what it's for me as an 8-year-old kid watching a guy die right in front of you? And I'm not trying to, you know, and I hate to bring this up, but it's just life, isn't it?
Kent Faulb, who was my head trainer the whole time I was at the Detroit Lions, he died in his arms. So I know all about the Hughes incident. So,
that's unreal.
And, you know, you can die. You can be paralyzed. You know, you can be maimed. But hey, man, you know, it's football. And if I had to do it all over again. Yeah, you know, even with my old man ailments that I have right now, I'd do it again in a heartbeat.
Well, we all know about Mike Utley. Unfortunately, it was at that game, Reggie Brown. I'm in the wrong places, my God, but at least I'm talking to a guy like you, you know, that obviously has lived it. And I guess when you talk about the Pontiac Silverdome in terms of how the facility went downhill, I'm just amazed at how the city of Pontiac let it go, and it ultimately turned out to be a disaster, and they had to finally get rid of that. I saw later knowing that everything you projected, nobody put any money into it. I think the Silverdome should have given the Lions full throttle to do whatever they want, never left the Silverdome. I hated seeing Lee Pontiac, but I understand why they went to Detroit for sure. Silverdome was my second home. I love that place, except when
right.
you had to play in it. I felt for you guys. I really did. Thanksgivings
right.
were great to me, being over
right.
the Dome.
Absolutely. Hey, I played in a bunch of them, and what a spectacle. What a spectacle. Of course, back playing on Thanksgiving, our big thing is why we love that so much is because that was the only time that we had any time off. We would have Friday, Saturday, and Sunday off, you know, because that was before Thursday games. And that was like such a blessing when you know, you're told what to do every day. For 6-7 months, you know, to have 3 days off, you know, that,
right.
that you know, we, yeah, that was a good thing.
Well, years ago, Kansas City wanted to see the Lions lose that game, and obviously Jerry Jones, I talked to him out in Arizona, said there's no way it'll happen. So Dallas kept it, Detroit, and then the rotating game. Go ahead, Bruce. Sorry.
I was just going to ask you, Keith. What do you think of, like, Amazon and all of these people getting involved in, you know, having different games on different days? I think that's just a little over the top. Do they really have to have all of these people getting in there? When I see Roger Goodell, who I don't particularly like, sitting there in the catbird seat with Jeff Bezos, there's something kind of stomach-turning to me about that. I don't know how you feel.
Well, I'm conflicted, I must say, because – I am motivated, right, to have the NFL continue to be popular because I'm pulling a pension from them, right? I want those
right.
checks to continue to come into my checking account. But beyond that, I hear you, and I agree with you. But again, I have a vested interest in keeping the NFL profitable.
I could hardly tell.
What's your opinion of Roger Goodell?
I'm not a huge Roger Goodell fan either. He just comes off to me like most of the owners come off, rich and arrogant. And, I always consider myself kind of on the other side. So, I have to concur with you as far as Roger Goodell.
Yeah. Yeah, because as an old Oakland, I'm from East Bay, obviously. He just let a team with Oakland has a lot of history in the NFL, especially with nicknamed plays. And then he said after everybody voted on the move that he tried to work with everybody here, and he didn't even set foot in Alameda County. So I have a personal problem with him, and I think he's moved very slowly on anything in the NFL, and yes, he is very beholden to the owners.
Yeah, and that he's moving slowly because that's what the owners want him to do. You know, he's just going to mirror what the owners want. And again, as mentioned, the owners, a group of old men who don't want things to change, and they're not going to change things unless they have to, i.e., if the bottom line is affected.
Okay.
Hey, like
well,
you
we're,
said,
we're about to.
It is a bottom line. Go ahead, Bruce.
We're about to run out of time. So if you want to get a quick question in there, then we'll close it out. Go ahead, Scott.
Well, the bottom line is you nailed it right on the head, Keith. I mean, the owners here are what they are. And I think that one of the greatest things I loved about the NFL, and I hate to bring this up, but you talked about it yourself, these owners are particular who they want as business partners, which is why Donald Trump never became one. Can you imagine the league with Donald Trump in it? God help us, right?
I second that, yes.
Indeed.
I had to throw that in there.
Keith, as we close it out, why don't you let our audience know how to get a hold of you and all of that stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. The easiest way, to check me out, sign up for my best money newsletter. Again, I talk more about money than in there. You know, I talk about myself, you know, in the musings from the farm section every month. Yeah, sign up at, again, that's financialauthor.com. Financialauthor.com. Take advantage of my free book offer as well as signing up for my newsletter, and you can see some of my stuff there. Thank you.
All right, and thank you for being on the show. I am Bruce Kessinger, Holy Roller, 91978, or Facebook. And Scott, give him a quick whatever, and then it's going to be have a nice weekend, folks.
All right, I'm Scott at Tribune South, and also please subscribe to South Florida Tribune YouTube channel. I'd love to have you as a guest on one of my shows, Keith, and pick this thing up and be able to continue to promote your book. So South Florida Tribune YouTube channel, please subscribe at Tribune South. Keith, it's been a pleasure talking to you. It's been an absolute blast. Live from Talladega Super Speedway out in Talladega, Alabama, you know, covering a race and talking to you. Doesn't get any better than that, Keith. Good stuff, man.
Hey, thanks so much, Bruce, Scott. I really, really enjoyed it. Great, great way to spend an hour on Saturday. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Got it, pal. Thank you.
Thank you. You were great. All right, everybody. Have
appreciate
a nice
it.
Weekend.
All right, guys.